You're listening to Taking Liberties. Taking Liberties is the official podcast of the Harvard Civil Rights, Civil Liberties Law Review. On this episode, we open with a panel discussion in which we discuss an Arizona man's claim that his religious freedom rights under the Religious Freedom Restoration Act have been violated by the Department of Justice's current immigration policies, a free speech ruling from the United Kingdom Supreme Court holding that a baker can refuse to make a cake that includes the design of the words "support gay marriage," and a discussion about the impact of the Supreme Court's ruling in the 2013 case Shelby County v. Holder has had on the current state of voting rights in the United States. Our guest for this episode is Judge Nancy Gertner. Judge Gertner is a former United States District Court judge of the United States District Court for the District of Massachusetts. She retired from that position in 2011 and is now a professor at Harvard Law School. Judge Gertner discusses her career as a civil rights attorney and how that shaped her time as a judge and what she sees as the biggest areas in need of judicial reform. Let's get started. The panel was recorded on October 23rd, 2018.
This is our week's panel. I am Zach Buchanan.
I'm Mark Satta.
I'm Graham Sternberg.
And I'll start us off this week, and I'm bringing to you guys news about Scott Daniel Warren. This guy is from Southern Arizona, and he was part of this organization called No More Deaths. And so the purpose of No More Deaths is that they provide humanitarian aid to immigrants who are coming across the border from Mexico, specifically, you know, like through the deserts and everything. I don't know if you guys saw like the news about canisters of water being left in the desert and then getting possibly slashed by Border Patrol. So that was No More Deaths. They're the ones that put out those canteens of water for immigrants making the trek. And back in January, No More Deaths shared a video of Border Patrol destroying these canteens. And it was a matter of hours after that that Scott Daniel Warren got arrested. And Warren was arrested for providing aid to a couple of illegal immigrants who were crossing. I think it was two of them. They were found in his barn, and he had been providing food and shelter. They'd been with him for about 3 days. And Warren's a professor at Arizona State. He gets arrested, charged with facilitating illegal immigration, and in the sort of strange clash that's happened, he has put in tension two of this administration's favorite things and has brought a religious freedom claim related to this immigration crackdown. And so Warren filed a motion to dismiss, saying that the immigration laws and the fact that this conduct was made illegal was an undue burden on his religious practices.
Oh, wow.
So he's essentially saying that his sincerely held spiritual beliefs require him to provide aid to those in need and to those that are in distress. And that is all that he was doing through organization No One Leaves. That's all that he was doing for these two people. And so the burden of proof should be shifted back on the government. The government should have to justify how this is being done through narrowly tailored means.
Okay.
It's this beautiful little back and forth. A couple of professors from Columbia actually filed a brief in support of his motion to dismiss. They filed it on behalf of professors of religious liberty, just sort of laying these things out. The Arizona District Court has since denied the motion to dismiss. This was recently, I believe, a couple of weeks ago. They denied the motion to dismiss. But because it was just a motion to dismiss and not a motion to present this affirmative defense of RFRA, they still sort of left it open. So the judge just said, I don't believe this warrants a motion to dismiss because, you know, his motion to dismiss was based off of the conduct mentioned in the indictment. And the judge said, you know, they're not going to be limited to just that. That's just their sort of probable cause for bringing these charges. So I don't think, arguendo, we can assume what the conduct they'll charge you with is. That's what I got from the decision that I read. And so we're not going to grant your motion to dismiss, but go for it. And so coming up, we might see a little bit more of this RFRA versus immigration crackdown.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's absolutely fantastic just to sort of toss up in the wake of, you know, was it this summer they formed the Task Force for Religious Liberty? This is, you know, this administration's all about the religious liberty front. And so I kind of love this claim and the fact that Warren is, and I can buy it on Warren's side. Like, you know, if you're a man who values your religious beliefs and the humanitarian side of that, then I can understand it. And I can imagine, you know, feeling the compulsion to provide humanitarian aid at the very least. These people are potentially dying out here in the Arizona desert.
Yeah.
I was just providing food, water, and a place to stay.
Mobilize the task force.
Right.
Sorry if you said this already. What are the charges against Warren right now?
Yeah, so the charges, it's 3 felony charges.
Okay.
And I know, I believe the, I'm not sure what the first of the 3 was, but I know the latter 2 had to deal with harboring migrants, is the language. It's to deal with the fact that he was facilitating this this illegal immigration that was happening.
Yeah.
And so he's saying that the acts that he was doing just in providing aid, that those acts were a part of his religious practice, just in providing the humanitarian aid.
Yeah.
And that under, sorry, I've said RFRA, the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, legislation meant to protect religious freedoms, similar to religions that require base conduct that is made illegal with blanket statutes, but it's part of sincerely held religious beliefs.
So the thought is something like, look, my religion dictates that I need to take certain actions, namely providing for the needs of others when I can, something like this. And the laws in place are restricting me such that I can no longer do these things that I feel religiously compelled to do. Is the basic idea?
Yes. And the Columbia professors who filed the brief in support took some issue with how the magistrate judge framed their report and recommendation after the evidentiary hearing, because the magistrate judge had mentioned that the immigration laws were not specifically burdening Warren, and the professor sort of laid out that sort of misses the whole point of RFRA, and that it's not meant to protect against legislation that's specifically burdening one person, but rather, because the magistrate judge pointed out, you know, these are general laws applicable to everyone, and the professor said that's the whole point of RFRA.
Because that's weird, because I mean, It's the whole point of RFRA in a very specific sort of sense, that Employment Division v. Smith, so Employment Division v. Smith was case, I think 1990, it was early
1990,
where the Supreme Court held that these sort of generally applicable laws are the sorts of ones where you can use a lower level of scrutiny in assessing whether or not there's a violation of the First Amendment Religious Free Exercise Clause. So the literal reason why RFRA was passed was because Congress didn't like that holding.
Yeah.
So for then for a magistrate judge to make RFRA sound more like Smith is to really – does really seem to be – to miss the point.
Yeah, undercuts the entire thing.
Yeah.
Sounds exactly like what the magistrate judge is trying to do here, saying, oh, this is a general law. It's not unduly burdening you specifically, so you can't say that there's a RFRA claim here when – yeah, it's the whole point of RFRA.
Right. So it seems like if Warren had brought a First Amendment instead of a RFRA claim, what the magistrate judge said would make sense.
That's fair.
But that's not what he brought. And that was probably a very intentional choice.
Yeah.
I'm a little concerned, even if he manages to get the court to apply strict scrutiny, I feel like there's a maybe an unsavory but very colorable argument that this passes strict scrutiny, depending on how the administration decides to frame it, right? So if they say this is about people who are helping other lawbreakers, right? So if you're just like an accomplice to a felony, then probably that doesn't pass strict scrutiny. Not a very compelling state interest. But even by like your strictest of strict scrutiny standards, if the administration decides to spin it as a matter of national security, he is helping these people come into the country. They are a danger to all of us. Obviously, I don't believe this, but like, we've met this administration, they're going to say these things. Then if a court's sympathetic, suddenly you're invoking like the Korematsu levels of strict scrutiny, and it's all bad. It's all bad, and probably his claim doesn't hold up.
Yeah, I think you're right that the administration is certainly going to claim they have a compelling list. And I think it's realistic to expect that a court will recognize the administration as having that sort of interest. They're going to make a case – well, they're going to make a case both for the interest and that it's appropriately tailored. But I bet we're going to see the court, wherever it ends up, a court recognize that there is, in fact, some sort of compelling government interest here, which is unsavory,
right,
was the word that you used.
especially after yesterday when the president was ready to just shoot from the hip saying that ISIS had infiltrated a caravan of refugees headed towards the United States. Like, who knows what they're going to say is the, like, national security concern here. Probably won't be true, but like you said, we've seen that the courts are ready to buy that.
So the current update on it is that Warren's lawyers just filed a motion to reconsider the district court's adopting of the magistrate's report and recommendation. I know motions to reconsider aren't often taken easily, but that'll be up. And then if that gets denied, then then it will move forward. And we'll see how the RFRA claim plays out in the future. On the topic of religious liberties and freedoms and things of the sort, I believe that our friend Mark Sada has an update for us.
That is right. We are going to stick on this topic. So we're going to start with talking about Masterpiece Cake Shop and connect that up to a recent ruling in the UK. So Masterpiece, by way of review, this was the case that reached the Supreme Court in its last term in which a baker refused to make a cake, a wedding cake, for a same-sex couple. This was in Colorado. This violated an anti-discrimination statute in Colorado. It went through the appropriate levels in Colorado, and the Colorado Civil Rights Commission concluded that the baker, Jack Phillips, had indeed violated Colorado state law and would have to make this cake for the same-sex wedding. So this ended up at the Supreme Court, and what the Supreme Court says is rather than settling the substantive issue of whether or not state law can dictate that one is discriminating if they refuse to provide items for a same-sex wedding, they instead ruled on the fact that there was hostility from members of the Colorado Civil Rights Commission in the treatment of Jack Phillips' religious belief. So they took particular quotes and other decisions that have been made by that body to say, look, part of what was going on here was that the Colorado Civil Rights Commission was making a judgment about the quality of Jack Phillips' religious belief. They can't do that. They have to look at the content of the belief neutrally and assume that Phillips is being sincere and make a judgment that way. But really what this ended up being was sort of like a punt on the questions that we really care about in terms of broad application for this sort of scenario. I shouldn't say really care about, because we also really care about not being hostile to religious beliefs, but it wasn't, that wasn't the impetus for why this was a case that caught national attention. So the UK has encountered a similar issue. There was a bakery owned by a couple. It was actually a chain of bakeries owned by a couple. Their last name, the Ashers. And a man came in and asked for a cake with the following design. He was a volunteer for a group called Queer Space, which was an LGBT community organization in Belfast, I believe, somewhere in Northern Ireland. And so the cake was supposed to have the Queer Space logo, Bert and Ernie, the presumably non-platonic version, although nothing indicated anything particularly non-platonic, and then writing that said support gay marriage. This was going to be used at a party being held by Queer Space. So not for a wedding, but it does actually explicitly contain the message support gay marriage. So after going through the appeals process in the UK, it ended up at the UK Supreme Court. And what the UK Supreme Court said was, on free speech grounds, the bakers don't have to make this particular cake. They have a right of refusal. So I think what's important about this case, the Ashers case, for future litigation of this sort, and as we just learned, Zach pointed out to me before we started, that there's been another cake baking case that the defendants have requested cert at the Supreme Court. So we'll see what happens there. But I think the reason why this case matters for us over here in the United States is both because of how it is similar and how it is different from a case like Masterpiece. So Masterpiece, the lawyers for Phillips did bring both religious free exercise claims and free speech claims. They said that Phillips was entitled to not make this cake both on free speech grounds and on religious freedom grounds. the court really did not substantively interact with the free speech claims in the opinion, except for Justice Thomas's concurrence. He spent most of his concurrence talking about why, on free speech grounds, Jack Phillips shouldn't have to make this cake. But if you go look at Jack Phillips, his website, the cakes don't typically have words on them. If you're looking at the design of the cake alone, you would be very hard-pressed to be able to tell that it was for a same-sex wedding over any other wedding. A lot of times the designs are generic enough that you can't tell if it's a wedding cake versus some other sort of special occasion cake at all. So there's a really big difference between using your artistic talents, to use Thomas's phrase, to make a cake that is custom in the sense that it reflects the aesthetic preferences of both you as the artist and the couple that you're making the cake for, versus an instance where you are literally writing out the words "support gay marriage." So the U.S. Supreme Court made a big deal in the majority opinion written by Justice Kennedy over the fact that the Colorado Civil Rights Commission had granted three other requests from bakers who didn't want to make cakes with messages related to same-sex marriage that they found offensive, derogatory, what have you.
Right.
There was this guy who was going around to bakeries asking for very specific designs, things like an open Bible that had a verse from Leviticus spelled out, and then, you know, a design of a same-sex couple with a big red X over it.
Mm-hmm.
So the messaging is a lot more explicit. And one of the things I found to be strange was, in the majority opinion, Justice Kennedy wrote as if it was somehow a mystery. He treated it as non-obvious that there could be a relevant difference between Phillips' case and these other cases, other than some sort of religious hostility.
Mm-hmm.
And this topic was taken up again by Gorsuch in his concurrence. Kagan's point in her concurrence was, well, there is an obvious difference. Namely, routinely the people that are asking for wedding cakes for a same-sex wedding are going to be gay people. Whereas routinely the people who are asking for derogatory messages about same-sex marriage need not have a particular sexual orientation or religious framework or any of these.
And dare I say, are typically not gay.
Right, right. Yeah. So she made that difference. But what I think the Asher's case makes really clearly, and it's interesting, the UK Supreme Court actually added a postscript where they talked about Masterpiece and kind of framed Masterpiece in light of what they thought the relevant criterion should be, which is namely, kind of the slogan is, according to the UK Supreme Court, this case, the Asher's case, was about a message, not the messenger. And it's not as clear in a case like Masterpiece that that is what's going on. They, in fact, concluded that, you know, the Ashers didn't know whether or not Gareth Lee, the man who came and asked for the cake, was gay or not. He was on behalf of a community organization where you're going to have straight, bisexual, gay members who can all be supporting gay marriage. There's not the same sort of demographic lineup where only gay people are supporting gay marriage, whereas pretty much only gay people are having same-sex weddings.
Right, right.
So I think it's an interesting case. I think the ruling on free speech grounds in the Asher's case is pretty plausible, because I think what it does is it protects bakers across the board from having to make cakes with explicit messages that they don't support. And this would kind of have, if applied consistently, a protecting effect for anybody to avoid having to make messages they don't agree with.
Hmm.
Whether or not free speech dictates that, I think it's not an obvious question one way or another to me, but I think it's a reasonable decision. But I think it's important the ways in which it doesn't line up with a case like Masterpiece.
So in that postscript, the UK Supreme Court did not rule on Masterpiece for us?
Well, they didn't literally
did
rule
they fix
on
our
Masterpiece
problem
for
us.
what they said was, I've got it right here. Justices Ginsburg and Sotomayor, in dissent, drew a clear distinction between an objection to the message on the cake and an objection to the customer who wanted cake. The other bakery cases had been clear examples of an objection to the message rather than one to the customer. So they basically added their own concurrence, being like, you all think this is very mysterious. Here's your answer. Here's how we frame the case for you to make sense of why Colorado can turn down Jack Phillips' requests to be able to not make this cake. But they're saying, yes, it is okay for these other bakers to not make these cakes. So that's how they have now framed the Masterpiece Cake Shop case for us. And I think it makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, I feel like it is incredibly intuitive to people who aren't our current Supreme Court majority, right? So when you're in a world where if you're Justice Thomas, you know, if someone asks you to like give $20 to a gay couple for their wedding, he's like, nope, that's forced expression. I will not put $20 in a card for them ever.
Yeah.
It's like money is speech, the end.
Right.
In that case, having to produce the fruits of your business for someone you disagree with, like, I see how they get there, but it's based on this incredibly flawed premise to begin with.
Yeah.
And I agree with you. The UK Supreme Court has drawn like a real bright and clean line that kind of packages the case nicely.
Yeah. And what I think is really interesting and important about the way that you framed that was, because of previous jurisprudential decisions the current majority on the Supreme Court has made, this is in fact what left them blind to some rather clear differences between Jack Phillips' case and the other three cases.
Right. So what I'm going to be talking about today is actually, I want to say it's the third installment of our organically created series on voting and voting rights in the lead up to some really spicy midterms this year.
Spicy is a good word.
Right? So what I'm going to be discussing is the Voting Rights Act, some notorious Supreme Court decisions surrounding the Voting Rights Act, and then I'm going to be taking that and applying it to some of the more prominent examples of, let's call it, voter interference that we've seen manifest in a few weeks leading up to the election. And we can talk about whether we think the Voting Rights Act, spoiler alert, if it were to still be in effect, would have any bearing on those problems.
Yeah.
So a little bit of background for the people who might not be familiar. The meat and potatoes of the Voting Rights Act comes in two parts. Section 4 and Section 5. Section 5 essentially outlines what you can't do, you know, what things are too racist for the Voting Rights Act to permit. And Section 4 dictates who Section 5 applies to. So Section 4 designates certain places as preclearance jurisdictions, a place in the United States that had either a test of some sort when the Voting Rights Act was implemented that prevented people from voting, so like a literacy test, or you had to be a jurisdiction that had less than 50% voter turnout or registration in the 64, 68, or 72 elections. Either one of those things could make you a preclearance jurisdiction. You could also, what's called bail in or bail out of that coverage. To bail out, you just had to apply to the Attorney General's office, Justice Department, and show them that you were behaving. On the other hand, you could bail in to being a pre-cleared jurisdiction if you were found by a court to be unconstitutionally burdening voting rights. Mm-hmm. If that happened as part of their judgment, they could say, well, now you're a pre-clearance jurisdiction. Sorry. And the ultimate effect of that between 1965 and 2000, and let's just say 13, for reasons that we'll get to in a moment, are that the majority of what we would consider the South were preclearance jurisdictions. And then smatterings of other places were also preclearance, so like parts of New York State and a few other strange locations throughout the country. California had some places that were preclearance. If you were one of these preclearance states, anything that you did to change your voting system, you had to get precleared, thus the name, with either the district court of the D.C. Circuit or the Justice Department. And they would either pre-clear it and allow you to implement it, or they would send it back and say you had to fix it. And the test that they applied to see if your plan was racist was to look at whether there was any retrogression, that was their like catchword, in the rights of specifically people of color living in those areas. Yeah. They were not allowed to forbid anything that kept the status quo. So if the status quo ante was racist and the new map was just equally as racist or equally suppressed the votes of black people in that jurisdiction, that was okay. They had no power to affect that. And this is sort of how things went until 2013, when there came a challenge to the Voting Rights Act called Shelby County versus Holder. It challenged the constitutionality of both Section 5 and Section 4 of the Voting Rights Act. The challenge was that you could neither forbid the activity that was forbidden under Section 5, that was unconstitutional, but neither could you set up these preclearance jurisdictions, that was unconstitutional. These were two separate claims. The question of Section 5 wasn't really reached. The Supreme Court kind of said, yeah, that's probably fine. The real heart of the argument was whether Section 4, the method by which a state became a preclearance jurisdiction, was constitutional. And the Supreme Court found that it wasn't. They did not like it because it punished states unequally. They spoke a lot about this idea of equal sovereignty, that by forcing one state to kind of undignifiedly clear its, you know, sovereign choices with another power while not forcing, say, Vermont to do that, that impugned the, like, sovereign pride of the state, and that wasn't okay. Because there was this sort of federalism, 10th Amendment, equal sovereignty issue, and because, as far as the Supreme Court majority could tell, we fixed the problem. They decided that the standards for making a state a preclearance state were unconstitutional, that they did not reflect the current status of voting rights in the United States and were just insulting. They sort of glossed over the fact that if any of these states had actually been able to manifest a history of remedying their past behavior, they could have been bailed out of preclearance. Mm-hmm. And jurisdictions have been. It's not unheard of. It's not even particularly rare in the grand scheme of things. They sort of ignored that, and they just struck the whole thing down. So since 2013, Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act has continued to exist. You can still punish preclearance states for failing to submit a viable change to their voting rights. However, there are no preclearance states because Section 4 doesn't exist, mm-hmm. and there won't be any new ones until Congress passes a new Section 4. And hilariously, and when I say hilarious, I mean sort of the grim, dark hilarity that permeates our time. The day that the Shelby County decision came down, states scrambled to file legislation changing their voting systems in ways that would have been impermissible before. So that's the history of the Voting Rights Act. Now, why don't we talk about some current voting violations, well, alleged voting violations. And we'll maybe discuss whether if the Voting Rights Act had still had its old power, we would have any redress for these things that are happening. And I know we've talked about some of them on the last episode, so I won't go into too much detail about exactly what happened. But why don't we start with Georgia? There's like 8 things going on in Georgia right now. So Georgia is a former preclearance state. And let's see what they've been doing recently. So in Georgia, 200 local voting precincts have been closed. Is that something that would be submitted, would need to be submitted to be cleared?
Submitted? Yeah, most definitely.
Definitely. I agree. I agree completely. It's a change in the number of voting precincts. Yeah, it's a change in any way in the electoral structure of their state. And so then the question of whether that would be retrogression really is, are any of those voting precincts in predominantly black neighborhoods? Assuming statistically the way these things tend to go, I would say probably yes. Right. Probably one of those voting precincts exists in a place with a black voter who would not be able to cast the vote as easily as they would before. And it probably would not be viable. They would have to, like, don't know, open up other polling locations, mm-hmm. shift districts around, make some sort of accommodation, or show that just like no one is using those polling places to begin with. And so there's not really any detriment to voting in Georgia. Presumably, they wouldn't be able to make that showing because 200 is a lot of precincts. So to find 200 places that no one would be inconvenienced if they were closed seems unlikely. They also stalled 500 voter registrations belonging disproportionately to black voters because of alleged problems with their voter registration. And so what this is an exact match program is what they're called. And these were implemented widespread after the Shelby County decision. And what they mandate is the information on your voter registration and the information on whatever form of ID you use to get that voter registration needs to be exact. And for white people, that's not hard. We don't have any tradition of like spelling our names different ways or relying on a nickname or our middle name or having last names that change structure based on who we're talking to. And all of those things are, I don't necessarily know that they're common, but they are things that happen in non-white communities. And so the people there will, you know, write on their application, their voter registration, you know, the name that they commonly go by and that they plan to give when they go to their polling place. But it won't match whatever's on their birth certificate or driver's license or, you know, whatever they need to provide. And so their registration will be forbidden. So this law was actually originally passed in 2016. There was a lawsuit challenging it on equal protection grounds. And then they pulled the lawsuit in a settlement, like they settled out of court. Mm-hmm. And one of the settlement stipulations said, you know, we won't do this unless we choose to pass it again in another legislative session, but in like more obfuscated language. So they settled the court case. And then a few months later, next legislative session came in and they repassed this exact match law. And as you might guess, disproportionately black voters, changes their voting patterns would have to be pre-cleared, probably would not be. The other thing that's been in the news recently, and that's just like a few of the bad things that Georgia has done. There's probably three or four others just since 2016. But the other thing that's been in the news a lot is actually North Dakota. Mm-hmm. And what North Dakota has done very quickly is just requiring that your physical address be on the ID that you use to vote, not a PO box. And the reason this is bad is that there's a lot, just the big Native American population in North Dakota, and predominantly they use PO boxes for their interactions with the Postal Service. Mm-hmm. The interesting thing about North Dakota is that the Voting Rights Act actually would have nothing to say about this. Because North Dakota was not a preclearance state, nor did it have any preclearance jurisdictions in it. So they have no need to preclear their laws. They could pass this law all they want. But what could have happened, which obviously won't now, is if someone were to bring a 14th Amendment claim against this, an equal protection claim, which would require them to prove that the physical address law was passed with discriminatory intent, which is hard, right? Then if North Dakota were to lose that challenge as part of the court process, the judge could say, all right, now you're a preclearance state because you did this. You did this thing. But obviously that's not likely to happen. In fact, it's impossible because of Shelby County. And I was saying earlier in the wake of Shelby County that there was just a flood of legislation diminishing people's voting rights. See, the Brennan Center says that there were 99 bills introduced last year that haven't been passed yet that will likely diminish voter access in 31 separate state legislatures. Texas announced a voter ID law within hours of Shelby County in 2013. Mississippi and Alabama, this is delightful, shortly after the decision began enforcing voter ID laws that had previously been banned. And North Carolina, actually, was not a pre-clearance state somehow. They dodged that bullet. But 40 of North Carolina's 100 counties had become individually pre-clearance jurisdictions. Since Shelby County, North Carolina reduced early voting by a week, ended same-day voter registration, and prevented provisional out-of-precinct voting. And their voter ID law which was struck down by a federal appeals court as unconstitutional, so a 14th Amendment challenge. Mm-hmm. That got struck down by a federal appeals court, and then the Supreme Court denied cert. So essentially that decision mm-hmm. stuck. That bill, which was rolled out a day after Shelby County, would have brought the whole state into pre-clearance mm-hmm. had the Voting Rights Act still had its previous power. And then Ohio, Wisconsin, Indiana, Iowa, none of them pre-clearance states, but they all passed strict voter ID or voter roll purge laws in the wake of Shelby County. Now that they stuck their heads out of the foxhole, they said, it looks safe.
Right.
Let's go. Let's
try some stuff out.
So you mentioned that, of course, with the overturning of Section 4, that everything sort of crumbles unless there's any sort of, I think you said, a new Section 4 passed equivalently. Mm-hmm. Do you think there's potential for anything of that sort if we see a blue wave, something like that, that this could be a soapbox that people try and take up?
I would not be surprised. Putting on my layperson's political strategist hat, I think it would be silly not to. Obviously, while there's a Republican president, they seem to be incentivized to veto anything implement a new Section 4. The one interesting thing is that the old Voting Rights Act, when it was renewed in 2006, had wide bipartisan support. There was always some tinkering around the edges to maybe benefit one party over the other, but it passed solidly. There hasn't obviously been any desire to regain that sort of bipartisan support since 2013. But yeah, I mean, for it to be passed before 2020 at the earliest, we would need supermajorities. Mm-hmm. But I think if there were a Democratic president and a Democratic Congress, it would be foolish not to do that. Mm-hmm. And the Shelby County decision even acknowledges that is a possibility. So it seems to.
Yeah.
No, I'm not saying that to sort of say that the majority was correct, but that it has not foreclosed the idea that this might be necessary.
One of my favorite lines from recent Supreme Court opinions comes from Ginsburg's dissent from Shelby County. She says that throwing out preclearance when it has worked and is continuing to work to stop discriminatory changes is like throwing away your umbrella in a rainstorm because you are not getting wet.
Ooh.
It seems like what's happened post-2013 is evidence that we were still in a voter suppression rainstorm and that the umbrella was doing us some good.
And we are now getting soaked.
Right. Yeah, that's why people like getting her on t-shirts and mugs and other things. Moments like this.
Moments like this.
Well, thank you, Zach, for having us on today.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you, friends, for coming. And I guess moral of the story at the end of that, if you can, go vote.
The following interview was conducted by Stephanie Horwitz and Annie Hollister on April 24th, 2018.
Judge Gardner, thank you so much for being here with us today. As a young lawyer, you represented activist Susan Sachs. How did that case shape your legal career?
It's interesting. It shaped it in so many ways. One way was, first, it's a question of, it gave me the audacity to try stuff. I mean, I was completely inexperienced. Here was a woman who wanted a woman lawyer. I mean, she was crazy because I was the only show in town. I had virtually no experience. But she figured that this was her last moment on the stage, and she wanted to have a woman lawyer. She figured she was going to lose. I mean, it was great being selected because she thought she was going to lose. But she wanted the symbolism of a woman lawyer. So the first thing was that it was an incredible opportunity, sort of drop-dead amazing opportunity that could have gone either way. I suppose that if I had lost calamitously, as many expected me to do, they would have said, well, you see, women shouldn't be lawyers. So that was one thing. It was an unbelievable opportunity. The other thing, there was something so wonderful about pouring your heart into something. Doing every conceivable thing in the case, everything, and winning. And I think that shaped me as a lawyer. It was as if somehow winning was only a question of how long and hard I was prepared to work on something. It really, maybe I would have been that way without this case, but it certainly helped me. I mean, I never believed, even though we had no idea what we were doing, I never believed that we would lose, which is kind of amazing. In fact, it reminded me of a student who was writing to me in our sentencing class who couldn't come one time because she had been working on a criminal case on and on and on and on. And she was so apologetic because she couldn't come to the class, and she won. It was a not guilty. And I told her that, as far as I was concerned, that was the experience. That was very nice for her to come to class and write papers. But the experience of pouring your heart into something and winning will shape you the next time around. Even if you lose the next 10, you know that effort repays, you know, the results repay the effort. And that made an enormous difference. I think the other thing is just sort of practically, I went from being Nancy who to all of a sudden I had a reputation, as you can see by the pictures.
You had a client who specifically wanted a female lawyer, which was unusual at the time. What kind of difference do you think that made, and do you think that can be important in other client-lawyer relationships?
It's wonderful and it's complicated. So it's on the one hand, I identified so completely with her. Very similar backgrounds. We were separated by perhaps 3 or 4 years. I knew the anti-war movement. I had come along. I mean, I was a lawyer when the movement went crazy, and so it caught me wanting to help people who were arrested as opposed to being arrested. She was on the being arrested part of the continuum. So I knew where she came from. I understood how she did what she did. I didn't approve of it, but I understood it. It was very, very painful because I was so close to her, so that sometimes I would visit her just because I thought she was lonely. The other side of the coin is you can't be a lawyer like that. You have to learn distance. And because you can't give advice, you can't evaluate it from any sort of dispassionate position. So I had the empathy part. I had to learn the distance part, and that was very hard. Really, you couldn't survive if your entrails were wrapped up in this case. You just couldn't survive being a lawyer, and you couldn't give her the advice that she needed to hear, which is that's really very nice. I know that will make you feel good, but no, we cannot try the Vietnam War in this case. It's really not a good idea. So what happens though is that the notion of reaching out to a client, finding his or her humanity and figuring out what you share also made me a better lawyer. You could talk to a jury because you knew something about the man you were representing or woman. So I did a version of that for the rest of my career. So.
And how did that experience shape your time on the bench and the way you approached that role?
Well, that, you know, if you want to talk about distance, that's an even more distance. So, in one sense, that's a great question. I mean, it's a combination of identification and distance. Identification means that when somebody comes before you in a case of, you know, that's worth $10,000, you understand that that could well be a whole lot of money to them. And that's the identification and empathy part. The distance part for the judge, though, is even more distance than the lawyer. You have to know that you have to be able to make difficult decisions. You had to be able to do that. So it's the same ingredients, but the mix may be different.
Did your view of the justice system change at all once you took the bench as a judge?
Yes. I loved the experience. I loved being a judge. But I was troubled by how passive the bench was and my colleagues were. It was like there's a passivity that comes from being a judge. You can't speak. You can't you know, you've got to be cautious about who you socialize with. But there was more than that that I saw, which, you know, I write about on the civil side. I call it duck, avoid, and evade. It was as if given an opportunity to throw out a case, you did, which seemed to me not the enterprise at all. That's on the civil side. On the criminal side, before the guidelines became advisory, there were lots of opportunities to interpret, analyze, criticize them, which I and some others took. The vast majority of judges did not. The analysis that I did was there for the taking, but very few other judges did that. And now when the guidelines became advisory, I mean, I think to some degree this is one of the things that pushed me off the bench. I thought this was going to be a moment of enormous creativity for the bench, and it wasn't. And I realized how passive people had become. You could wring your hands about mass incarceration, but there really was stuff that judges could do about it. They just weren't. Part of that was a function, I think, of the guidelines were birthed at a time of incredible anti-judge animus. Part of that was a sort of torrent of criticisms about lenient judges, and people didn't want to take that on. I didn't care. So life is easier if you follow the guidelines. No one can criticize you. Or if you say, I have no choice but to dismiss this case, which is just rarely true, sometimes true, but rarely true. So that's what was surprising to me. I write about this now, maybe the bench in the 60s, when you're facing new civil rights issues, was a different bench, where you really had a sense that the law was a vehicle for social change. When I'm on the bench, the concern, I mean, I would issue an opinion in a criminal case, and someone would say, aren't you afraid of being labeled an activist? And I go, you know, I don't actually give a damn. but the notion that that was a mantra says something about where the bench has changed. Now we're in an interesting time. The Republicans have made activism, a compliment. I mean, they're proposing people who are determined to undo various constitutional protections, which is really very interesting. But the time that I was on the bench was a time when, you know, the overwhelming pressure was to move the cases and keep your head down. And that was disappointing to me. That was very disappointing.
What are some things that you think judges could be doing? You mentioned that judges can have an impact on mass incarceration. What are other ways in which judges can use their role to further social justice or civil rights more broadly?
Well, you know, so again, on the civil side, I was astonished at the preliminary injunctions in the travel ban case, because there were 1,000 ways to duck that case. And I think in ordinary times it would have been. And what were the ways? Well, you know, this was a preliminary injunction with respect to an issue that the government had extraordinary authority over, namely our borders and national security. It was a balancing test, and in previous years, you know, plaintiffs would be balanced out of court. What was the harms? Well, if you talk about national security, that always trumped everything. Bad verb. But what you saw was judges actually balancing and coming to grips and being critical, as opposed to taking what had been the path of least resistance. Whether that continues throughout the next couple of years, I don't know. So on the civil side, there's certainly stuff to engage. A piece I'm writing tonight is on the Me Too movement. Courts have been abominable on Title VII, absolutely abominable. And part of it is the sense that we were post-gender, that these things didn't matter. Well, I wonder whether the Me Too movement means that when you have a case about whether the harassment was severe and pervasive, you'll err on the side of saying yes rather than saying no. And then on the criminal side, I have a whole class on it. I mean, there's so much that can be done, so much that can be creative, that doesn't sort of lead to noise, doesn't lead to disparity, because if I find a fabulous program, or if I can identify the characteristics of an addict that would respond to that program and I write it, the judge next to me would do the same thing or should do the same thing. So, I mean, I think that there really is lots to do. And then aside from that, just being a critic about one of the last decisions I wrote, somebody said, you know, public safety demands that this guy goes to jail. And I said, you know, I've had it with that. Public safety does not demand that. The public doesn't demand that if they know that he has three, you know, disabled kids at home. Nor does it make sense in terms of his life. No, public safety demands he be on the street. And I had an engagement with what was mass incarceration and what these arguments were. So, yeah, there's a lot that a judge could do. You just have to do it, you know. But there are a lot of outs. That really was my first point. There's so many ways to be on the bench and simply not ruffle any feathers.
You talked a little bit about the relationship of politics to judging with the Republicans and, you know, appointment of judges. How do you see that relationship? Of course, judges are supposed to be impartial and separate, but it seems there's a distinct response to judging and civil rights movements. And where do you see the interplay?
The cat is out of the bag. I don't think that we can depoliticize judging in the United States. I don't think that there's any way to do it. I think that the most that you can hope for, there are two things. One is that the people you select, whatever the selection process are engaged and smart and, you know, willing to see both sides. That they are, whatever their past has been when they get on the bench, that they're willing to see both sides. You know, I think that we have to learn to applaud people who see both sides. I guess what I'm saying is I think politics is inevitable, particularly in the foreseeable future. And the most that you can get is really good people who, wherever they started, would be thinking carefully about what they're doing. You know, I said that when I was sworn in, I said, you know, I know there are a lot of people in this audience who are not so sure about me because I had been a criminal defense lawyer and a civil rights lawyer. And I said, the issue is not where you start, it's where you end. And you know, I started with the feeling that sentencing was not badly done. I ended with that feeling, but I couldn't always act on it. You know, and I felt reasonably comfortable that I was following the law and where I could tried to temper its harshness. So it's a long way around saying Elizabeth Warren and Senator Markey now have a judicial selection committee that I'm on. I'm this chair of it. And even under Trump, we invited everyone to apply. And we went through pages and pages of applications. We interviewed people. We came up with, you know, three candidates who knows who they, what their politics are. That was less important than the fact that they were good lawyers and knew what they were doing. So I think it can't be apolitical because we are just too far down the line. But it can be at least political plus meaningful, you know, academic skill qualifications and, you know, reasonably diverse, even within that range. What I found in helping select judges is that if you ask the same set of questions, so one question was, what kind of trial experience? I don't care whether you're Republican or Democrat if you never step foot in court. What's your community experience? If you're someone who's sort of only known wealth and interacting with one swatch of people, how will you relate to the poor guy in your court for whom $10,000 is a lot of money? So by asking the same set of questions, we were able to get people of different parties who qualified. So, but I don't think you can. The merit selection can mitigate political selection. It can't substitute for it, and I don't think there's any way of going back.
What are some ways in which you think the judiciary needs to change or can change?
Well, you know, it's interesting. One of the things that we talked about in the selection committee was that. People may find this controversial. Elizabeth Warren wanted to look at diversity, not just race, gender, and transgender, not those kinds of categories. She wanted to look at diversity of experience. And man, that makes a great difference. I mean, I would be at judicial conferences where someone would say, as I said a moment ago, oh, this case is only worth $10,000. I didn't come from wealth. That was a lot of money to me. So you want people who knew what it was like to represent poor people, who know what it's like to walk into a courtroom with a client, walk out without him. You want people who have some context to bring to the table. Someone could be of color and go from a U.S. attorney's office into a big firm, never seeing most of what you're likely to see in court. They could be wonderful judges, but there's no question that you want to have a mix, you know. And so that actually, you know, the public defenders and prosecutors, I felt enormous money pressure, but it wasn't the reason that I left, but part of the reason. And, you know, when I looked around at my court at that time, I was the only one who wasn't rich. You know, my husband was the legal director of the ACLU. He, you know, he does God's work, and God doesn't pay anything. You know, most of the judges get selected from a trajectory of, you know, U.S. Attorney's Office, big firm bench. They could be wonderful judges, but there's so much more to the profession than that. So, I think that that's really, really important. And also, you know, the selection process actually matters to you when you get on the bench. When you know that you've been selected in direct proportion to your never having said anything controversial, when you get on the bench, that perspective continues. That leads to, gee, I'm just going to keep my head down. So there are better ways of doing the selection.
So you also mentioned how the federal judiciary tends to want to duck, evade, and avoid civil litigation and civil rights litigation in particular, I imagine. Is that just an outgrowth of judges wanting to be conservative, not wanting to make waves? Is it an efficiency rationale? And more importantly, what advice do you have for future civil rights litigators who want to push these cases through?
Well, let me answer. What's the reason for it? I think part of it is, and I think that part of it was this anti-judge wave, the model of a judge became the efficient case manager. The model of the judge became the, can I get you people to sue, to settle? There may be cases in which that's appropriate, but there also may be cases where you really want a reasoned decision. You want to say something so that the next time it comes up in the next case, someone would say something. So I think part of it was the anti-judge stuff, and then part of it, and case management, you can be a judge much more easily in case management. Early on, I think I was on the bench for 2 years. One of the new judges who came on with me said that his caseload statistics were better than anyone in the court. And I looked at him and I said, and what does that mean? You know, but it really was. It was almost competitive, you know. Now, some of the case management stuff was absolutely appropriate. I needed to have an antidote to my ability to get lost in a case. There was no question about it. There were files on my radiator that, you know, cried out to me every day. So there was no question that you wanted to, being efficient mattered. It really, being efficient was a good thing. But if you have a choice between dismissing a case or letting it go forward, and you could do either under the law, what system says dismiss? It seemed to me to be crazy. What can lawyers do? Civil rights law has become so technical. A thousand ways to miss the statute of limitations, a thousand balancing, you know, not balancing, a thousand rules. I kept on wanting people to say, let me tell you what this case is about. And then I want to tell you about why it mattered to have these laws. And then we'll talk about the procedural issues. The debates got to be so technical. Let me give you one example. One of the last cases, guy got up, it was a salary case, and he got up and said, Judge, we paid this guy what the market would bear. We paid him this because of the market. I had been a civil rights lawyer. I had, you know, taught the subject. I said to him, let me say that again. You're paying him this because it's what the market requires? The market screwed up. That's why we had Title VII. The other lawyer was just saying, no, the market wouldn't bear that. He was saying the market, no one stepped back and said, here's the context. What are you talking about? Or a case of mine that I think is now going before the Supreme Court, not a case of mine, but a similar issue. There was a postal worker who was being harassed, sexually harassed, because people thought he was gay. He, in fact, was not out. And he sued the Postal Service. It became a Santola versus Potter. And the one side says, you know, he was being harassed because he's gay and you know, homosexuality is not covered under Title VII. The other side, but he's not gay. And I said, what? And so I went back to my chambers and I found a 1970 article from a professor at NYU about how the core of discrimination is stereotyping, is treating someone because of a generalizing about their gender. And so he was being harassed because he wasn't seen as a real man. It doesn't matter whether he was really gay or not. I wrote that decision. I let the case go on. Neither side had given me that. And that case was then cited by the Seventh Circuit, and somebody just told me it's on its way up to the Supreme Court. It makes my day. But my point was that it was so easy to throw the case out. Homosexuality is not covered. It was less easy to try to figure out what was really going on and to be creative about it. That was the harder part. And, you know, civil rights advocates need to think like that. Let me tell you what the underlying mechanism is here. We talk in class about felony murder and the challenges to felony murder. You know, I mean, those challenges, we have to get people to challenge felony murder for juveniles. No one had thought that there was a great leap from Miller and those cases to, gee, felony murder keeps you from litigating the very things that Justice Kagan talked about in Miller as important. You know, the relationship of peers, whether this is, hot pursuit, various kinds of things. So lawyers have to be more creative. The duck of avoid and evade, I think, changed the bar too. So, and you got to teach people differently here, and I have to teach everything in this school. I just have to teach everything. You know, that's all.
In the world of Title VII and civil rights claims, do you think that ADR and arbitration clauses have changed the face of that in the courtroom and just in the world more?
Well, if you think about when Title VII was passed, there were various models for Title VII. It could have been we could have had a code. Someone could have sat down and come up with a workplace code. We could have done it like the NLRB, which you could have had a government agency that adjudicates. Instead, we decided to go to the courts. And the idea was that the courts, common law courts, would articulate norms of conduct. So this you'd know from the decision, you know, what fits on what side of the line and what doesn't, or from the jury verdict. ADR and arbitration totally wipes that out. Non-disclosure agreements keep you from knowing what the underlying conduct was that triggered this. Arbitration totally buries it because arbitration is confidential. So much is waylaid into a forum which provides no guidance for the next round that, I mean, I think it's undermined Title VII.
What do you think about lifetime appointments of judges?
I think it's a good thing, even though I didn't take mine for life. I think it's a good thing in part because age is so complicated. You know, if we had the Massachusetts courts have a retirement, mandatory retirement at age 70, and that was set years ago when 70 was old, 70 is not old. And you lose so many really good judges with that kind of mandatory retirement. I think it's a conundrum. Of course, there are people on the bench who are just not functioning and they should go, and that's a complicated task to get rid of them in a life tenure situation. But I don't think that happens very much. But what more and more will happen will be people in their 70s and 80s who are really still with it. So, I mean, I also think there's something there's something good about the sense of being creating a protected space for judges that life tenure provides. So, yeah, no, I think that that's good, even though I'm a spry 70-year-old.
I just want to follow up on what you said about civil rights litigators. It seems so many of them are making these technical arguments because they're responding to what they think judges want to hear, because judges are making these technical rulings. So does the change need to come from the judges first, or should the civil rights litigators just be creative and hope something sticks with some judge and then it will spread? Or,
well, I think it's more than just being creative. You have to, I keep on wanting to say, I would say this to my clerks, why did we have this rule? And let's sort of try to understand it. So habeas is the classic example, right? I mean, there are 5,000 ways to avoid getting to the merits in a habeas case. And so, you know, I wanted someone to go back and say, why did we tighten habeas statute of limitations? Part of the reason we did is that we began to privilege finality over truth. You know, well, gee, we privilege finality over truth before DNA exonerations. Maybe we should think about the balance being different. And we privileging one over the other didn't mean there were not still discovery rules and what's equitable estoppel for forgiving this. And that makes sense. So you have to abstract. You have to tell the judge the issue is not when did he file and which day it was. The issue is, why do we have these rules and do these facts meet it? And that's a discussion we just don't have anymore. You know, so that's what I'm talking about. I think the lawyers have to start with it. I really do. I do a lot of consulting on litigation, and I'm usually telling people that, you know, by the time you get to the middle of your brief, if the judge is asleep, you've lost. And, you know, I see that too often. You know, here is what the rule is in most cases, judge, but this is different, and here's why.
Can we talk about sentencing?
Yeah.
Sure. You've obviously talked a lot about it and teach a class on sentencing. And I would love to, I think we would love to hear your thoughts about how it's changed, what the changes have meant for judges, what the changes have meant for defendants or for the criminal justice system more broadly, and how we can improve sentencing going forward.
This, of course, is the course.
in five minutes, please.
Well, I mean, I first I practiced before mandatory sentences and mandatory guidelines, so it was shock to the system when I became a judge. And then I've traveled widely and talked in other countries, and so you can actually see what was sentencing like before. You also see what sentencing still is in Australia, Canada, Israel, any other country that has a non-mandatory system, what happened. And American sentencing changed so dramatically, not just, you know, mandatory minimums were not necessarily something that the left didn't want. The idea was mandatory guidelines, not so much mandatory minimums, but mandatory guidelines that would be lower. The country took a turn for retribution in the 80s. There was a crime spike. It decreased immediately thereafter, regardless of the increasing imprisonment. There's a racial component people write about the increase in punishment, because, all of a sudden, if you characterize someone as a felon, you don't have to see them as a person anymore, and it mapped onto Jim Crow, as Michelle Alexander writes. There was the collapse of the war on poverty, and it was almost as if we began to feel that poverty was so complicated that the only response was criminal. We couldn't undo it, but we could certainly deal with the consequences of it, which was crime. So the whole bunch of reasons why we just went through the roof in terms of sentencing and numbers that nobody else had ever seen before. I mean, I shudder to think about poor academics who by the 80s were writing about the stability of American sentencing, and it just then took off. It changed the bench. It normalized numbers that nobody had ever thought about before. It normalized jail. The only issue, 50% of federal sentencing had been probation. All of a sudden, that changed dramatically. The only question the judges were thinking about was how much time and nothing else. The guidelines, I'm also persuaded, completely changed the bench because you didn't have to think. You became a clerk. I look at this list of numbers and where are you? The kind of balancing and sort of profound discussions that you see in other countries stopped here. So, in Australia, you'd see a discussion about, should I take into account a prior crime from 10 years ago? How should age figure into this case? What about mental health issues? And the judge would write about it, struggle with it, and surface it. That discussion stopped in the federal courts. It's coming back a little bit now, but for the most part, it stopped because the issue was mental health is, irrelevant under certain circumstances. Addiction is never relevant. The discussion in federal court became, what was the quantity and what was your criminal record? All of the interesting philosophical, criminological, scientific questions just were not happening in the court. And now that the guidelines are advisory, in many parts of the country, they're still not happening. And part of it is, it was as if, I wrote about this, it's as if judges began to think that they were not, sentencing was not their expertise anymore. Somebody else should come up with guidelines to tell us how to sentence. I can't begin to tell you how antithetical that is to judging in every other country. It really changed the bench. So advisory or no, it just changed the bench. It changed advocacy. The day after Booker, I had a murder case, I think, and the lawyer begins the argument, and he goes and says, Judge, I think this is a Category 2 rather than a Category 3. I said, why did he kill him? Those kinds of discussions, why did he kill him, was not even, you couldn't check that off anywhere. So and why did he kill him seems to me to be a relevant question, because maybe that could help me figure out who he was and what could be done. If he killed him just gratuitously, that would be one thing. If it was, failed self-defense, but you don't even get that conversation anymore. So that's changing a little bit, but still not much. The woman who pleads guilty, much like the cases I've described, because of she's with a man who is who's dealing drugs and she's helping. I had a plea once where I had the strongest sense that she was being beaten, and the lawyer didn't raise that as an issue because you couldn't actually call it diminished capacity. And in other words, there was a strong category for that, and she wasn't there. But gee, would I want to know that? She may not be there, but she may be someplace else. So lawyering changed. And the mandatory minimums meant that there was a rush to the courthouse to plead guilty. So you'd get guilty pleas in which no one had really meaningfully done anything in the case. So, yeah, I think it transformed so many parts of the system, and it's very hard. It's going to take work to undo it from judges, lawyers, prosecutors, probation officers, everybody.
What kind of work?
Well, we saw that in our class. I mean, I gave two hypotheticals in my class, and we had four judges and probation officers in the class. One hypothetical was the quintessential hard one. A man who had been a bank robber all his life, fundamentally drug addicted, never could hold a job. Every time he got out of jail, he'd rob another bank. He'd rob another bank without a weapon. He'd stick his finger in his pocket, and he'd walk out, and that's what he used for drugs. By the time he's in his early 60s, the last time he goes to prison, he goes into a reentry program. He's 63. He's terrible record. Not violent, just these silly bank robberies. But he does well in reentry. He has a family. He gets a job. That begins to unravel because he has car payments and he, for various reasons, winds up going back to, I don't know whether it's drugs or whether, I don't remember whether it's drugs or alcoholism, and winds up robbing a bank. What do you do with this person? My students, of course, gave everybody probation. They didn't, no one in the class believed in jail. It's an interesting discussion. I thought there'd be some pushback, but nobody believed in jail. But the judges were all over the map. The judges were from, 4 years to 15. And the judge that was at 15 thought that the guidelines were like a spigot. You were in guidelines or you were not. If you were not, there's stuff you could do. But if he fit within it, it was 15, not 14, not 13, not 10, not, And that has to be addressed. One can believe that guidelines should frame what we do so that there isn't rampant disparity. But you can still say, this case is not the prototypical case. And so it shouldn't be 15, it should be something else. I mean, it will take a lot of unlearning. The concept in cognitive science is anchoring, and once you put numbers on things, they suck the air out of the room. And I think that that's what we've seen. The problem is that our numbers are 15, 20, et cetera. So it will take some unlearning.
And even advisory guidelines create a default.
Totally, they do. And it would be one thing if they were thoughtful, but they really are not. I know I've written about this. They were written in 6 months, I believe. And it's not that they were written where you said this number has to be tested in terms of deterrence or whatever. The numbers were picked out of the air. It was almost as if it was more important to get any guideline for disparity purposes, regardless of what it was. And that mentality has continued. So, the notion that we should pay attention to these guidelines, sure, some of it, there was rationality behind it. The guy who's dealing more drugs is more culpable than someone's dealing less drugs. But if he's dealing more drugs by being on the same corner and selling dime bags over a month, that's a different dealer than the guy who's dealing that quantity, in a barrel one day. Mm-hmm. I mean, there were questions we stopped asking, which makes no sense. But what do I really feel?
Well, what do you think lawyers and trial attorneys, policymakers, what can people who are not on the bench do about it?
Well, the easiest answer to that is first eliminate mandatory minimums. I actually think that you should throw out the guidelines and redo them. I'm not against guidelines. I'm against these guidelines. I think that you should have broader ranges. I think there should be a listing of mitigating and aggravating factors. I think you have to encourage judges to describe what they're doing in those reasons. I didn't assign it to the class, but there was a decision written by a Canadian judge in a Native American case. A horrendous rape. Captured the woman, raped her multiple times. So he describes that. And then he also describes this kid's background. And the kid's background, which was written as if profoundly we failed him. Family to family, no school, intervention when he was an infant because he was being beaten, raped by his own family. I mean, on and on and on and on. And the judge at the end of describing the horrible crime and the horrible background essentially says, what do I do? And that discussion is so important. You may disagree with the outcome, but that discussion is so important. And he ultimately gives him time, not as much as others. Why? He describes why. So if we had a guideline system that would be, here are the mitigating factors, here are the aggravating factors, you weigh them and you write how you weigh them, I think that that would make an enormous difference. Then when, if he goes out and hurts someone again, what the judge tried to do would have been clear. As opposed to having that bad thinking be done by a commission, because of who's doing it in the abstract. So I think that we eliminate the guidelines, we make it aggravating and mitigating factors, we broaden it. We do then post hoc reviews. In other words, we do analysis after the fact to see how bad the disparity is, whether there's racism in it, and then we share that with judges and you make adjustments. You deal with this as a discretionary system with a bite. As opposed to a mandatory system. Because there are some cases that just don't fit. And the guidelines are so bad, most of them don't fit.
Great. I think that's all the time we have for today. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
This has been a real pleasure.
You've been listening to Taking Liberties, the official podcast of the Harvard Civil Rights, Civil Liberties Law Review. Music for the podcast was written and performed by John Sada. Our panelists today were Zach Buchanan, Graham Sternberg, and Mark Sada. The editors-in-chief of the Harvard Civil Rights, Civil Liberties Law Review are Bree Frank, Amber Ashley James, and Ian Epler. The executive audio content editor is Mark Sada. Special thanks to our guest, Judge Nancy Gertner, and thanks to you for listening.